Thank you, everyone, for being here. This is session 1F, which is by Rob Auerbach, Fighting Fight or Flight. Sorry, mouthful, Rob. So thank you all for being here. Rob's going to speak for about 30-ish minutes and take some questions at the end. There might be, he said he will invite questions along the way, but he may choose to defer them depending on where it sits with the presentation. So Rob has spent 15 years as the Chief Legal and Policy Development Officer for an American statutory compensation authority. During the last 17 years, Rob has assisted 10 governmental entities in 4 distinct cultures in reviewing and improving their workers' comp systems. These projects have resulted in significant improvements in economic performance, coupled with upgrades in the care and benefit design given to injured people. These successes have been achieved largely through the development of systems and protocols that apply understandings from behavioural sciences to the claims environment. In Australia, Rob has worked as a consultant for various private and governmental clients, including Comcare, the Department of Veteran Affairs, the Department of Employment and WorkCover New South Wales. He has written more than 50 published articles and book chapters and speaks internationally on resilience, rehabilitation and personal injury compensation system design. And I think in light of most of the comments this morning, Rob has some interesting things to say on dealing with that sort of 10, 15, 20% of claims that cost a lot of money in our systems. So welcome, Rob.
Thank you. I think when audiences clap at the beginning of a presentation, it's probably hope. And hopefully, if you clap at the end, it won't be because of relief. I have the sort of unenviable job of getting you in your post-lunch doldrums. So I'm going to try to keep it very quite stimulating. You'll find me a bit of a jump around and use my voice kind of guy. I hope that doesn't offend, but I need to keep you awake, all right? So I want to start with a question. Do you think you could talk to this person right now about return to work? Probably not. You know, if you were able to engage this person, which is unlikely, hippopotamus being the animal in Africa that kills the most people of any of the wildlife, if you were able to engage this person, what would you find? Well, you'd find very elevated physical response, heart rate, so on and so forth. You'd find that they were talking really fast, that they were engaging in very black and white thinking. It's either about my survival or it's not relevant. You would find that if you're in the role of helping them, all of a sudden you are their very best buddy. And if you're not, you're part of the problem. You're part of the enemy. So, second question. Does this sound at all either like some of the claimants that you deal with, on the one hand, or some of the colleagues that you deal with sometimes when they're under stress? And what I want to suggest to you is that there's a lot known about this reaction, but it's not really been applied to the claims environment before. So we're going to spend about 40 minutes just looking at the technology that's been devised to apply the understanding of the sympathetic nervous system response, the fight or flight response, to the claims environment. Because you'll find that there's some tremendous practical implications, both for management of claimants and for also for interpersonal management within your industry, within your workplace. And I think that I want to emphasize that that's really, really important. If I don't fall over first. That's really, really important. PwC did a study a couple of years ago saying that people who work in the insurance and financial sector have the highest rate of mental illness of any sector in Australia. You are under a lot of stress in your jobs. You're actually seeing that reaction a lot in your workplace. And to look after yourself, to help manage upwards and manage downwards, you need to have this information to apply to your own life, not just to the management of claimants. So, what is fight or flight? The first thing to understand about fight or flight is it is a very primitive response. I'm not going to go into brain geography. It's interesting if you like that sort of stuff, but really it doesn't matter. But it's based in the oldest parts of the brain, the animal parts of the brain. And what it does is it changes the response when somebody feels threatened. Now you notice I said feels threatened. And that's really quite critical here. It doesn't matter whether or not the threat is real. If the threat is perceived, you'll get the same reaction. How do you know that? Anybody ever go to a horror movie? Anybody ever have a fright at one of those movies? You know, you're sitting in a theater, that it's up there on the screen. It's not actually going to come out and bite you. But do you have that adrenaline rush? Do you have that, do you have that clenched muscles? Of course you do. It's perceived threat. And the directors are very, very good at getting you to perceive that sense of threat. That's what makes a horror movie. Because it brings on that reaction in a very safe context. And some people will find that thrilling. Well, good on you if you do. But the point here is that it's a reaction to perceived threat. It's both physiological and psychological. Where we see it in injury recovery? I don't know if any of you have ever been injured. I have been. And I tell you that the first thing that you think of when you're lying on the ground is, will this come right? Will I be able to get up? Will I be able to carry on my life as normal? Will the people in my life still talk to me, still interact with me? All these kinds of things come flooding in. And you have that acute reaction very, very quickly. And so you see this in the early phases of recovery. That, by the way, is why it is that proper early intervention can be so successful, because in part it can control or reduce this reaction if it's done well. And that means that people don't go into this me or them survival or non-survival kind of mode. But we also see it in long-term cases. I reckon probably all of you have experienced directly or indirectly at one time that claimant for whom everything that they deal with you on is black or white. It's my way or the highway. Everything, no matter how small, carries the weight of survival. It's life or death that they get this additional allotment for home services. Okay? Either you're their friend because you're giving them stuff, or you're the enemy. You're out to get them. They can't really get beyond that. These are the people who are writing letters to the minister. These are the people who are spending immense amounts of energy on little tiny things. So they're also the people who are soaking up a really disproportionate amount of your resources, your stomach acid, and so on. All right? That's when we're seeing it. Not in the middle. Most people get over this reaction, the acute reaction, very well. They recover. They move on. In the middle group, where people who need some support to recover, they move on pretty well. But it's at the ends, the immediate reaction and the difficult 15% that Andrew was talking about. That's where we see this kind of reaction, and that's where we can make a lot of difference. Fortunately, those are the two places where making a difference will have a huge leveraged impact. Now, the physical effects. You're all familiar with this sort of adrenaline rush. When something happens, you get it, and you're ready to go, and that's fight or flight, right? But that's not the only reaction that you have. Okay? The whole body reacts for the purpose of marshaling your resources to eliminate danger, or either to confront it and defeat it, or to take you away from the danger. And that means that the glucose and oxygen reserves that you carry in your body on a normal day-to-day basis get very quickly depleted. Okay, it's almost instantaneous. Those people who had an adrenaline reaction, if you remember, do you remember getting shaky afterwards? That's the depletion of the glucose and oxygen that you feel. There's another major chemical that's put a hormone that's put into your bloodstream at the same time as the adrenaline, although it actually reacts slower and stays in your bloodstream much, much longer. It's called cortisol. And the purpose of it is that it facilitates the breakdown of fatty acids and the ability to turn those into energy that your body can use. So essentially, what the body has is a first line of defense, get the heck out of there or knock down whatever is threatening you. But if the threat is prolonged, then the body has additional resources to make up for what it's already burned to help you confront the continuing threat. Now, if you're a caveman and you've just successfully eluded the saber-toothed tiger, that cortisol streaming through your bloodstream just sort of helps you recover. It's not a big deal because life goes back to something a little bit more simple. But if you have a continuous sense of being stressed, of being threatened, then this cortisol actually builds up in the serum, in the bloodstream, in your serum, and becomes a poison. It becomes a toxin. And we know that heightened blood cortisol is associated strongly with a number of really, really ugly comorbidities, including lowered immune function, insomnia. I don't know if any of you saw the presentation I did 2 years ago about the impact of insomnia on building a disabled persona, but that is a really interesting linkage there. Increased waking. How many claimants do you see put on weight and have that impact their recovery? Increased blood pressure. Increased cholesterol. Heightened risk of heart disease. Heightened risk of mental illness. Okay? And overall, reduced life expectancy. Cortisol is the stress drug. You read about how stress kills. It's because of cortisol poisoning. And that is part of the fight or flight response. Also, by the way, it's a really, really good predictor for poor recovery. Because you've got all these comorbidities that have been added to complicate the case. But it's not just that, it's the psychological effects. Like I say, when you are in fight and flight, you've got two options, survive or die. That means everything's black or white. There's no gray area, there's no contemplation of stuff. You're entirely in your fast-thinking mode. And in that fast-thinking mode, you have very impaired analytical skills. You don't have the time for slow thinking. You don't have the time for consideration of your long-term best interests. Okay? What you do have time for is making snap judgments, friend, foe. Help me, hurt me. And you're going to fall into that category one way or another. Your memory and learning have been compromised. Everything runs towards overreaction when viewed from the outside and aggressiveness. Does this sound like some of your claimants? Not a big percentage of them, but does it sound like some of your claimants? Does this sound like some of the interactions you see between colleagues under high-stress situations in your offices? Okay. I recommend that a large percentage of the people that we regard as, quote, difficult claimants are really claimants who have, for whatever reason, fallen into a cyclical or chronic fight-or-flight kind of situation, and therefore they're reacting from a survival mode rather than from the rational thinking mode that we want them to be coming at to try to pursue their long-term best interests. That's bad news, but there's good news. If you think about it, if you've ever had one of those stress reactions, you know that you don't stay there. You calm down. Because although this is an autonomic nervous system function, it's something that happens without conscious thought or without decision, there's also another autonomic nervous system reaction that balances you, that brings you back to homeostasis, called the parasympathetic nervous system. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute. I just want to emphasize once again, and I'm going to do it one further time down the line, that this applies to you in your role, in your office, to your reactions and interactions with your coworkers. So this has a lot to do with how people manage and how they manage difficult relationships in the office. Also has to do with burnout and turnover, which, by the way, is devastating both to the bottom line of your organization and also to its effectiveness. Because when you turn over people, they have a productivity learning curve, and you lose that expertise and you lose that being in the system, and literally the whole rest of the team gets put under additional stress as a result. So it becomes almost a super heterodyne effect, of a feedback effect that creates additional stress for the remaining staff as well. This presents some opportunities for good or for ill. And I'm going to say very clearly, if we continue doing things the way we have, we're missing these opportunities. The way to go forward is to consider what's been learned in other contexts about this reaction and how to invoke something a little bit different and more useful. If you keep people in their fast-thinking system and don't let them get into a mode where they can analyze and consider what their long-term interests are, the probability of having success with return to work and things like that, very low. And by the way, the probability that there are going to be problems in your life is very high. So we've got a choice here. We can either make it better or continue doing what we've been doing. But I'll guarantee you, if we make it better, you're going to save time. You'll spend a little bit of time, not much, but you'll spend a little bit more time in getting these reactions tamped down, but you won't have to respond with a 13-page letter, okay? You won't have to respond to the ministerial, and so on and so forth. Your loss costs will go down. We know that that 15% amounts to, what, 85, 90% of your total loss costs? So if we could cut that down by 2 or 3%, what would be the leveraged impact on your total loss profile? You can actually create a lot of profit or available funds by simply looking at this kind of reaction and tamping it down a lot. And more importantly, perhaps most importantly, wear and tear on your own people. Okay, on the claims side, as I said, the body has a natural reaction, okay? The fight or flight reaction, the sympathetic nervous system, is balanced by the rest and digest system, also known as the parasympathetic nervous system. And it calms the reaction down and lets you come back to something like whatever your normal is. And it's really important because nobody can listen when they're in fight or flight. Going back to that original picture, I asked, what would happen if you tried to engage this guy in conversation? Well, you all knew intuitively what the answer was. He wouldn't listen to you, not unless you provided him with some safety. He wasn't in a position to listen to you, and neither will be the claimants who are having the same reaction. However, it turns out that in another field, the way of mechanism for invoking the parasympathetic nervous system has been well developed, well tested in multiple fields. Okay, it was developed in leadership training and management coaching. It's been applied very successfully in education and in HR. But it's almost unknown, except maybe on an intuitive basis, in workers' comp. But this is the STARF system, which was developed by a guy named David Rock, who works now, used to be in Sydney, but now works in New York City. This system is tried and tested for as a mechanism for invoking the balancing mechanism that's already hardwired in your system. All right, so let's go through SCARF. It's an acronym, okay? SCARF, the first part, status. The question is, in status, is does the person who's in the fight or flight reaction feel like you value them? If they feel like you value them, then that starts invoking the ability to listen, the ability to treat you as a friend, who is seen as helper rather than an enemy. It starts to invoke the ability to move on from it. It actually starts calming down the reaction. So, what are things that do that? picking up the phone and not just letting it ring, answering emails. When you get somebody on the phone, knowing who you're talking to and not having to have them prompt you as to what their case is about. That is to say, that very obvious treating somebody like a person. Okay? All very easy to do. Okay? And the people who have been selected for people skills in the claims management role will do it intuitively. They know that that's important. It's also relatively difficult to train because it requires a certain personality orientation. And you really need to recruit for that personality and orientation. Note from ACT notes. Second, certainty. Anybody who's ever been injured knows that you feel a great deal of uncertainty about the future of your life. And that uncertainty is exacerbated if you're in a compensation system, because it is complex, it is, you know, it has difficult rules, it has things that don't make sense on an intuitive basis that have been designed in the system to obtain bigger outcomes across populations and don't necessarily apply to the individual. So because of this, people look for certainty, and what's happened, and we saw the reference to it in the last plenary session, is they look for certainty, and when they don't have that certainty, what do? They go hire somebody to help them get them certainty. Number one is usually a lawyer. And when people lawyer up, I've spoken on this and written on this elsewhere, when people lawyer up, you know that the outcome is going to be difficult. You heard John Nagel talking about ODG. In the ODG protocol, there is the ability to predict the impact of comorbidities. One of the comorbidities that is singled out for prediction of worse outcomes is the presence of a lawyer in the case. And statistically, they've shown that across the board that's the case. And I can, if you want, get you an article where I've referenced a large number of studies that unequivocally give you the understanding that putting a lawyer into the case causes a chain of events, even with the best of intentions, that's likely to result in a bad outcome. So if you can give them certainty, then you can give them the ability to trust that their interests will be looked after. And that allows them to put down that worry and start to move on. Autonomy. This one's very, very scary for claims folks. Okay? Let me tell you that the studies are incredibly clear that when you have somebody who participates in their own medical treatment with informed consent, an informed choice about the course of their treatment, they will recover much better than people who have been told what they need to do. We're very lazy. More so probably in Australia than some other places where I've lived, but we're very, very lazy about trusting the doc to tell us what to do. But it turns out that that doesn't work very well for at least a couple reasons. First of all, and especially in the cases that are difficult, the doc probably doesn't know. The docs haven't had, you know, a large percentage of our difficult cases are cases that involve secondary psychological implications to the original injury, whether the original injury is psychological or physical. Well, how many doctors have had training in psych at all, vanishingly small in the GP population, and how many doctors have had training in the implications of secondary psych? Almost none. Few OCDocs, but basically very few other people. As a result, misdiagnosis is rampant, and treatment that is not effective from a research or evidence base is very, very common. So giving somebody the ability to participate in their course of treatment can be very, very helpful. Amongst other things, it can do what you always have had trouble doing. Okay? How many people have tried to get a treatment plan out of somebody acting in the role of a psychologist or psychiatrist. And you get this sort of vague mumbo-jumbo about treat as necessary, essentially, right? With oftentimes open-ended. Well, I'll tell you what. If you look on the Australian Psychological Association's website, you'll see an evidence-based medicine compendium on that. And the gold standard treatment for virtually everything that we deal with the exception of PTSD, is cognitive behavioral therapy. Well, cognitive behavioral therapy, by definition, always proceeds with a limited, time-limited and session-limited treatment program. If you don't have a treatment program, then you're not getting CBT. And as a result of that, if you start looking at the issue of autonomy, you can have the worker start doing the job that you're having trouble with because they don't want you, the site doesn't want you to be questioning them. And that is saying, wait a minute, what are we going to do? How long is it going to take? And if the worker has that kind of autonomy in the business, then they actually do better. And the research is really, really unequivocal about that. When somebody participates in an informed manner in their treatment, they do better in their outcomes. Relatedness. Relatedness is the feeling that you're aligned with them. I reckon probably everybody who's ever done claims has gotten some version of, you're only in it for saving money. You have no interest in me. You're just trying to save money for your company. Right? And largely that's true. Okay? Largely that's true. That's what your role is. The question is that role in conflict with their role? Let's presume for the moment that their real best intention is to get better and get back to their life. Well, if you view properly that you are in the business of getting them better and getting them back to their life, because ultimately that will result in a lower claims cost across the board, then yes, you have different motivation, but you're really aimed at the same thing. So there's the ability to essentially co-opt this perception of you being on different sides because you're really intending to the same outcome. And finally, fairness. That's a matter of transparency and doing what you say. If you tell somebody that that you're going to get back to them, you got to get back to them. Okay? If you tell somebody you'll take care of something before next Tuesday, then you better take care of it before next Tuesday. Or if you can't, you better call them on Monday and explain why you can't and give them a more realistic deadline. But you've got to be open, honest, and fair with them to do this. Now, if you do those things, it's almost magical what happens with really difficult planning. And I've had some people who, let's just say other people have given up on, okay? That they're about to be thrown on the trash heap of long-term claims. And it is astounding what happens when you, A, pick up the phone and talk to them, call them by name, show familiarity with their claim, show familiarity with what it is that, you know, is going on with them, that status. Give them information. For some reason, we've gotten this strange impression in claims that if we give people information, then that means that they're going to try to use it to take advantage of the system. Could somebody please show me one documented study that shows that? Because I can show you dozens and dozens of circumstances and studies where giving more information on an institutional basis had huge negative pressure on claims costs. One of the places that I worked for, the work cover in the U.S., had a set of 26 little booklets. 12 of them were for employers, 14 of them were for workers. And they explained in simple fifth-year school English what was going to happen next, what they had to do about it, and why it was happening. And it turned out that when we introduced that, the overall incidence of disputes went down markedly. The overall claims cost in the system went down by about 15%, and so on. And I can show you time after time. Marriott Corporation, a big international hospitality group, does similar kinds of things, and they've said similar kinds of results. Information helps people. It doesn't create new claims. Okay, there will be a very small percentage of people who use information to rock the system. Fair enough. Okay, I ran a claims fraud investigation unit for 5 years in the process of that. Genuine fraud is vanishingly small. Misconduct is what most people were talking about. But in the situation where you've got that, guess what? The people who have that intention have already found out what they need to know to rock the system for the most part. Giving more information about what's happening and why isn't going to help them. What it's going to do is help the people who need the information. Autonomy. How difficult is it to essentially give people choice all the time, as much as you can? We seem to think that if we control everything, good results happen. I'm just talking about return to work, okay? I'm not talking about economic results. And apologies to anybody who's with the Victorian scheme who might feel upset by about what I'm going to say. But SafeWork Australia tells us that Victoria, which is the most regulated scheme, the most control-oriented scheme in the country, has the worst return-to-work rates, the worst long-term absences. Is that accidental? Is it a factor of something else? Perhaps. But it's really, really suggestive that control isn't associated with cost or with return-to-work. Let's look at Tasmania. Anybody here from Tasmania? Okay, well, I don't have to apologize. But Tasmania is probably the poster child for the most laissez-faire system. They have a very tiny staff. They don't generally intervene in claims processing regulation at all. They have essentially no regulatory presence. And according to SafeWork Australia, they have a fairly good, a little bit above average, rate of long-term claims. Looking at those two data points together, it becomes suggestive that perhaps control doesn't equal good outcomes, unless what you're defining as a good outcome is control of money. So if you're looking at return to work, maybe control isn't the best thing. If you're looking at human outcomes, maybe control isn't the best thing. Maybe sharing control and allowing people to buy into what you're doing is a good idea. Relatedness, well, look, you've all met the resistance. If you can overcome it, then you're well down the line to being able to have a conversation. And fairness, every one of you have experienced that bursting of the bubble of trust, okay? And that's exactly what was happening here. When the bubble bursts, you can rebuild it, but it takes time. Thank you. Okay, so there's a variety of helpful and unhelpful kinds of things. I'm not going to read through these. You'll be able to have access to my slides another time, but I've really already talked about this indirectly. A couple really easy sentences here. They're the kinds of things you can script to your team. First, the statement that every first responder who's been well-trained is expected to say when they first attend to an accident scene. Okay? Any first responder who's been well-trained will say some version of the words, the worst is over. Why? It says positive expectation. It says, I'm relating to you. I've got your back. I'm going to take care of you from this point forward. You know, it's a promise that you've got to fulfill. You've got to be there for them at the end. But this really ticks a couple of boxes. Second, There's some talk about bringing restorative justice into the Victorian scheme. Well done. Because there's ample studies out there that suggest that the power of apology with regard to healing is immense. Now, mostly we're taught we can't apologize because that has some sort of liability implications. I guarantee you, and I've been a lawyer for over almost 30 years now, I guarantee you that uttering the sentence, "I am really sorry that this happened to you," has no liability implications whatsoever. None. But it means a lot to the person on the other end. And this one is that relatedness thing. The idea that you can be on the same team even if you have different motivations, because you have the same outcome in mind. And one last sentence I want to recommend to all of you is, what would you like to see happen? If you can get your people to start saying those words, then you now have already brought them into the team. You've made it collaborative. You've given them autonomy. You've given them, a step up into finding certainty. And you've really related to them person to person. So these are not really difficult things to implement. It can obviously be used in management internal situations. Okay, I don't need to go through the implications to just sort of point out that in these difficult situations, when you see somebody in a meeting start to breathe fast, turn red, clench their fists, they're in fight or flight. If you calm that down, then you're able to continue the meeting. If you don't, their participation in the meeting is over. Okay, whether you know it or not, their ability to listen to what's happened is over. So you need to calm it down to be able to move forward at all. Some scheme design options. Well, look, complexity is the opposite of predictability. So if you can simplify and give more information, you can create more certainty and more autonomy in the system. We tend to run off of distrust. Joe Calafiore said this morning, we come from a place where we were in economic peril, so we're trying to protect the system. Well, that means that we distrust the claimant. And guess what? Pete claimants are really, really good for picking up being distrusted, and they read that as a threat. They read you that as you treating them as the enemy. If you're going to treat them as the enemy, they're going to treat you as the enemy. This becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I'll tell you what, having done fraud investigation, real fraud is vanishingly rare. Maybe 1 out of 20 reported cases were cases that we were able to make criminal prosecutions on. Bad conduct, that's a little bit different story. That's a bigger percentage. But fraud is relatively rare. So maybe you'll catch or prevent one of those, but at how much cost to the rest of your system in terms of other cases that you have exacerbated in terms of their severity. In medical decisions, as I say, the ability to deal collaboratively with the doctor, as opposed to having the doctor handing down decisions, has really, really well-documented impact. And I want to point out that DVA, right now, has successfully implemented a system where they actually ask the injured veteran to participate in the designation of their rehabilitation goals at each step. And they go very small, step by step by step, to determine what the next rehabilitation goal was. And they're having remarkable success, world-leading success in rehabilitating injured veterans. We do a lot of things in our claims design that are kind of silly. We have claims teams, and we think that cold handovers of cases between claims managers is okay. It's not okay. It creates fear. It creates distrust. It bursts that bubble that might have been, and people feel like they have to then tell their story all over again. And the more they tell that story over and over again, the more it becomes a script. And a script never changes, so how are they going to change? So we really need to look about at claims handovers. And to do that, we really need to look at vertical horizontal segmentation. It's become this sort of holy thing in Australia that segmenting claims horizontally is a good idea. I'm not so sure. Not if what you're trying to do is get efficiency of fixing widgets, then yes. If what you're trying to do is to heal people, maybe not. Maybe vertical integration of claims is a way that needs to be tried. People generally work better when they buy into the solutions. Yep. Okay. Yep. Benefit management. Look, there's some interesting things in design to be determined about benefit delivery. People run up costs, and when they run up costs, there's a problem. There's some interesting work that's being done now with people, claimants driving their scheduling of appointments and so on and so forth. And finally, if cortisol is a lingering problem in the bloodstream with all sorts of negative comorbidities associated with it, then why don't we start using it as a lead indicator for determining whether or not the strategies that we're using are being effective enough? Now, obviously, it's an invasive procedure, and so it can only be used on trials. But what would be wrong with having an actual objective lead indicator of whether we're doing well or not? This is just sort of a bit of a summary, and sorry I've run a little long. Are there any questions?
Sorry, Rob. I think you'll have to be found over the rest of the conference for questions because we do have other sessions to run into. Can you please join me in thanking Rob, and we have a little bit of time.